Our content notifications for this episode are that we talk fairly elaborately about disability and ableism as it plays out in the movie, and also talk about sexism and misogyny.
Greetings, you're listening to Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into a horror film and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology. My name is Pace Warfield May, and I am the christening medal that shows up over and over again, which apparently is a weird custom in certain regions Catholic. Of the world. Connected to Catholic baptism that I had no idea about before I had ever seen this movie.
Same. And I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the snowbank that attempts to cradle Joanna and Kathy.
Aww.
Kind of fails because they still die, but I attempt. Mostly snow.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really what we're going for.
Always.
Yeah.
Always just also, the snow.
Also, welcome to season 5, the best season ever, because 5 is the best number ever, of Horror Nerds at Church. I'm Pastor Emily, and I use pronouns like they, them, theirs, and we are glad to welcome you to this new season, officially.
Yes, indeed. We have had, in theory, I will cut this part out if needed, but in theory we have had an episode dropped last week for Holy Week on Jesus Camp, which was a fun teaser for all of this upcoming season. But this is the official launch of our ghost season, the spookiest season ever.
It's gonna be spooktacular. I get to use indeed. All of the awesome puns that I learned from Vampirina. Oh, I'm so excited.
Oh dear.
It's gonna be fabulous.
You have been warned, listeners. And I'm Pace Warfield May. I use no pronouns or pronouns like they, them, theirs. And I, if you know nothing about our podcast, I thought we'd each take a moment to introduce who we are in case we're gaining any new listeners this season, because Ghostbusters is a pretty far-reaching franchise, much beloved, full of nostalgia, all of those things. So I am a PhD candidate at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, where I'm writing a dissertation on Martin Luther and particularly a queer theological anthropology of his Genesis lectures. Lots of big fancy words for saying that Luther was more hip to the queers than any of us realize, and even he realized, I think, in the time. So that's who I am. Lifelong horror fan as well.
And I am a pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which is the simultaneously most progressive and very middle of the road Lutheran denomination in this country. And I live in Baltimore with my chosen family and serve as a pastor here and also podcast a ridiculous amount, both here at Horror Nerds at Church as well as its parent, sister, cousin, Nerds at Church, both of which fall under the umbrella of the Diaconia.Faith Collective. And I am not a horror buff. I am the non-horror person. We are discovering the ways. We started last season mostly, but we are discovering the ways that I engage with horror and that I enjoy horror and the ways that I don't. So if you are a big time horror buff like Pace, welcome. And if you are someone who does not consider yourself into horror, I have been there and sometimes I'm still there. So welcome to you as well. It has been fun for me. This is getting a little bit into what our podcast is about, but last season we covered Nightmare on Elm Street, and it has been fun for me to figure out the tropes of horror, which has helped me appreciate horror more. So maybe that will happen with you, or maybe you'll just delight in us talking nerdy about Ghostbusters and ghosts and all things spooktacular.
And queer and horrific. Yeah. So a little bit about the podcast, Horror Nerds at Church, is if you're listening to this when the episode airs in early April, we will have just celebrated our second birthday as a podcast, which is March 25th. 2023 is our second birthday. So we got started in March 2020, March 2021, during the ongoing pandemic stuff, which is still ongoing, but in different ways. As a spinoff of Nerds at Church, and I'll spare going into the story of how I got into those details. You can find it in several places in Nerds at Church and Horror Nerds at Church's archive. But basically, we take a movie that is either scary or called a horror movie, or one that we justify as tangentially related to horror in some way. Horror adjacent. And do a queer reading of it, talk about some of the theology of it, and just generally nerd out about it. It's a good time. So,
yeah.
Thank you for joining us. Yeah.
Also, I don't know if we said it explicitly, you don't have to be at all theologically minded to appreciate this podcast or what we talk about. We have had, we've definitely had atheists on the podcast, and sometimes we'll get into theology and sometimes it's more queerness and all of the things, but we do not expect our listeners to be like Christian.
I identify as a public theologian, but my own theology and my own belief system would fit better within the term post-Christian or agnostic than strictly adhering to a theological creed or something. So I myself have an expansive view of that, but then also just want to say that horror as a genre borrows heavily from religion. And so I take seriously the words that Elizabeth Johnson says, that the symbol of God functions in society. And so if horror is saying something about religion, then I feel like it's regardless of what one believes, there is benefit to talk about, well, what is horror using religion to say in this particular instance? If that makes sense.
Indeed. And as a pastor, I am committed to challenging the ways that religion harms. And so this is part of that. We get to deconstruct religious imagery, iconography, theology, all of the things. Deconstruction! I had coffee before we started, in case
congratulations.
Out of my church is horror mug that I stole from a housemate, that is available on our merch store at bit.ly/nerdsatchurchmerch.
Very nice. Yeah.
I don't remember what our bit.ly is, but that works.
I don't either.
Yeah.
But going with our new season, though, we have something fun to announce, which is that we have a new Patreon tier. Right. So we have seen extraordinary over the last year, like just the support that all of our listeners have done, given us over the past year has been amazing and continues. And we especially like to thank our Patreon supporters for being able to help support us. So that way this, we're not just throwing money into like a black pit, but called the podcast, but in fact, it is actually able to be like getting closer and closer to being self-sustaining, which is a lovely thing and place to be. And to continue to support that goal, we added a second Patreon tier. Go ahead, Emily, tell us all about the $5 Patreon tier.
Because it's the best tier, because it's five. Just kidding. The $10 tier is awesome. So our $5 tier, which is the tier that we've had this whole time, is now called our Horror Nerds tier. And it is actually the tier that I am on, because I became a Patreon before I became a host. Just because you become a Patreon supporter does not mean that you get to become a host, but it also doesn't mean that you can never be a host or a guest, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, our $5 Horror Nerds tier gets you one BooTube episode, one movie commentary, and occasional sneak peeks and other bonus stuff from our each month from our podcast. It also gets you added to our newsletter, which is currently in a renovation phase, remodeling phase. We're it's currently on pause, but we're looking at what would be the best use of the newsletter and the best way to connect in terms of the newsletter. Also, if you want to be a newsletter recipient, you don't have to be a Patreon subscriber to get it. Just saying. You can sign up anytime.
You can sign up by clicking at the link in our show notes. But also, just to say that right now, due to the our newsletter is presently through Review, which is this free resource that was operated by Twitter, and due to the ongoing implosion of Twitter under its leadership of someone who clearly does not know what he's doing. Is a fascist. Review is one of the things that is kind of getting gutted. So like we just need to find a new platform, as well as the big picture reimagining of things too. So that's some of the practical stuff going on behind it. The Review stuff too. But if you don't know what a BooTube is basically an episode like this, except instead of talking about a movie, we're talking about a TV show. And a movie commentary episode is basically Emily and I sit down, watch a movie, and talk through it about all the thoughts that come as we watch it. And then you can, if you line up your, we count down, so you can line up your own streaming device or TV or DVD or whatever to the beginning of the movie, and then basically you're watching it with us and you can listen to our thoughts on it just like you would a movie commentary track on a DVD or Blu-ray or something like that.
So that's what those are. Our movie commentary for March was on Beetlejuice, and so the original Beetlejuice or whatever. So if you want to check out Beetlejuice and see what we think, that's a way to do it. And our BooTube for March was on Kindred, the show based on Octavia Butler's phenomenal book. So if you watched Kindred, liked Kindred, are curious about Kindred, that is a great way to like watch it and get some more engagement. And you can leave us comments and let us know what you think, and we will gladly respond.
In addition to that $5 Patreon tier, we now have our $10 Horror Buff tier. Super exciting to launch this one. It's been a long time coming. We've been talking about it for a while.
I have all the background noise right now. I am sorry.
It's all good.
Like somebody mowing the lawn or something, and sirens, and there was a helicopter. I live in Baltimore. This is what we get.
But
we can get that out if it's not like audible.
Well, I can just mute your track during background noises.
Oh, that too.
When you're not talking, it's only an issue when you're talking. But, so yeah, our $10 horror buff is, basically, I have been told by almost every guest who's come on this podcast that I'm really good at picking horror movies that really jive with, like, their interests, and especially if they're new to horror, people like Emily or past guests like Susanna Porter, is one who said this many times. River Cook Needham has said this many times. But basically, I guess that's my superpower, is playing matchmaker between a horror movie and a person. So it's with the $10 tier, you get everything in the $5 tier, in addition to getting tailored monthly horror movie suggestions from me. It does not have to be from me, and it does not have to be horror. If you want suggestions from Emily, they are mostly in the sci-fi fantasy realm, and also in the kid TV show and movie realm, but they would be happy to provide recommendations.
And, you know, Disney and superheroes, and yeah, I could recruit some, like, what is called the Fun Times at the Island suggestions from Susanna, if you wanted just, like, documentaries about how awful the world is. I do not have the superpowers that Pace does, but I am glad to, like, combine efforts at that, or even suggest books, because I do have quite the book collection fandom.
So, yeah, once a month you'll get, basically, I'll probably put together a questionnaire, and based on that questionnaire, I will provide a few recommendations on a monthly basis to you. And Emily may participate too. So check that out. Also, you'll get a shout out on our episodes in our main feed once a quarter, just saying your name and saying thank you for supporting us, just a way of publicly showing recognition for your support. And then we will additionally have extra episodes drop from time to time that are only available on the $10 horror buff tier. So
it's true.
You'll have exclusive access.
You'll find out a little bit more in less than a month.
Yes, yes, indeed. So that's a lot about who we are. But yeah, support us on Patreon by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. Also linked in the show notes. And now that we spent nearly 20 minutes just talking about ourselves, I guess we can start talking about this movie.
What are we watching?
That was amazing. We are watching The Changeling. Came out in 1980, directed by Peter Medak, and importantly, this is not the Angelina Jolie one that came out in the early 2000s. So if you're listening, hoping for that Angelina Jolie one, maybe at some future point we'll cover that. But that's not the one we're covering.
Yeah, but it could be a future movie commentary or something. You can have voice and vote in that, I think, just by following us on Twitter. But also, our Patreon supporters definitely get to, like, vote on stuff sometimes.
Yep.
I made that up. But it might be true. We might make it true.
It is true.
I'm wrecking this.
It's okay. Emily came in like a wrecking ball.
I am super excited for this season. It's going to be ridiculous and wonderful. And speaking of, for those of you who ever like to play drinking games, one of the ongoing, basically the only ongoing, like, option for take a drink is our next segment, which is first memories or experiences of this film. So in this segment, if I say that I've never seen the film until watching it for this episode, then you take a drink. And if Pace watched the film sometime before the age of 9, I think was our thing.
I think then we should bump it up to 12, but yeah, somewhere before the age of 12.
Yeah, as before becoming a teenager, then you take a drink. So, Pace, first memories, experiences of this film.
You will not have to take a shot when it comes to me this time, because the first time I watched this movie was, I would say, about 5 years ago. And I've watched it a few times since then. Huh. But yeah, this was part of an intentional trying to fill in the gaps of the horror classics I had missed. So this was one of the films that I felt I had to watch because I had not had the opportunity to see before.
Nice. Well, sorry, folks, but you do have to take a drink for me because the first time I watched this movie was for this episode. I had never seen it before. I don't think I'd even heard of it before. I think I had somehow heard the term Changeling maybe, but yeah, did not know anything about the film.
I feel like that can be another, maybe not a shot, but a sip, is if Emily hasn't even heard of the film before, in addition to having never seen it.
Watching it. It works. I'd go for that.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, this movie, we can just get right into the history of it. This movie still is considered one of the greatest horror movies ever made. I'm very interested in hearing how you will rate it, Emily, at the end, because having seen it for the first time, in being both like a kind of newbie to horror and then also like in the year 2023, 40 some years after this movie was made, does it still hold up as this great horror movie? I don't know. But definitely when it came out, this movie and The Shining both came out in the same year. Both are kind of haunted house flicks in their own way. Both tackle it very differently, but with like a level of like genre defining gravita to, I guess, both films that ever since then movies have, especially ghost movies, but horror movies in general, have emulated things that have happened in The Shining and things that have happened in The Changeling. So
interesting. I did not realize that. But yeah, it is very obviously like a 1980s horror film or whatever, as in not a 2023 one. But yeah, there is a lot that I'm excited to dig into in it as well.
Yep. Yep.
One of the things that came up while we were watching it that feels applicable for the like background behind the scenes is like the way that they use music in the movie. And I think I complained about this in The Shining, where I was like, they build suspense with the music and then nothing happens. That's not how they use it. That's not how I experienced it in The Changeling. But like, there's very much a sense of music as both atmosphere and plot, which is partly because the main character is a pianist, and so like he plays music for part of it. But I think that's a really cool way of like, there is the atmosphere in the background and all of that that a soundtrack is like intended to do and be, but also it is part of the plot and like the melodies that he plays and then are part of the music box and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and credit to Rick Wilkins for being the composer for this and just really creating a memorable score. And this kind of gets to something we talked about in our Suspiria episode from last season, when we talked about diegetic versus non-diegetic sound. So diegetic sound is sound that the characters in the film can hear, and then non-diegetic sound is like stuff like the soundtrack and the music and stuff that, or the suspense cues and pickups that only us can hear as the audience, and kind of blurring that line, like what is diegetic, what versus what is non-diegetic, what sounds are playing of the music box or whatever is the character actually hearing what is only meant for us? It's kind of blurred in this film, just like it was in Suspiria, which was, I thought, a cool use of that in both cases. Yeah. George C. Scott and Trish Van Devere were married in real life. So I remember as we're watching the movie, Emily asked me if there was supposed to be a romance subplot in there. And I was like, I don't know, because it doesn't seem like their characters are dating, but like there's definitely some chemistry there. And I think it's owed to the fact that they're
actually married. Well, and there's definitely like courtship, right? Like they go horseback riding together.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they go horseback riding, like English riding, which is a whole other like qualm that I have about the thing. But yeah, they go like they do things that make me think like, oh, and she never mentions having a husband or anything or a spouse. And so it's like one of those things where it's like, ah, newly widowed gets in a potential relationship while like trying to solve ghost mysteries. I don't know. It felt like it was an easy setup for that kind of a trope, or multiple tropes all rolled into one. And so I was like, and then nothing happened with it. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like, I don't need romance and I don't need a romantic subplot, but it felt like they were simultaneously creating one and then not bringing it to fruition. So I did not know that they were married though in real life.
And George C. Scott, very famous actor and supposedly notoriously difficult to work with, although in this film apparently he and the director got along well, but he's known for being this Dr. Strangelove, speaking of Stanley Kubrick films, The Bible in the Beginning, which one of these days I would love to do a mini season or maybe a Patreon mini series or something on like Bible epics, because it's not like quite horror that there's horrific elements to them and they're just a mess.
As long as we can also do The Prince of Egypt.
Yeah, probably. I love that movie.
At least one VeggieTales.
Yeah, we'll do BooTube on VeggieTales.
Hilarious.
But yeah, George C. Scott was also in A Christmas Carol, 1984, probably one of the more famous versions of it that doesn't include Muppets. He's in 1997.
If it doesn't include Muppets, I mean, really.
I mean,
that's my Nerds at Church co-host hat coming out. Yeah.
If this, I was not gonna give you a new segment on Horror Nerds at Church. If we were to remake this movie with Muppets, who would they play? I'm kidding. We will not do that. Maybe every once in a while, but not
regularly. That can mostly stay over in Nerds at Church land.
Because who wants to talk about Muppets like being serial killers or
whatever? That was one of the ones, when we did like the Slaughter of the Holy Innocents, Kay was like, this is so hard because Muppets are just kids. And I was like, well, yes, and also like that's who was slaughtered, so
right. But George C. Scott is in horror circles, aside from this film, probably most known for being in The Exorcist 3 and also 1984's Firestarter. So look out for those. But also, speaking of a name in horror, Joshua Jackson, 90s heartthrob from Dawson's Creek, but also was in several 90s slasher movies. This is his first on-screen role. He played one of the infant babies. He was only several months old. His mom was assistant director, Fiona Jackson, so that's how she got him on the movie. Just kind of a cool little bit note there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's
fascinating. All right.
And then this is also very interesting, and I'm sure will be interesting for Emily too, because of the way it connects to their life and also The Shining. The story idea of this movie came from Russell Hunter, who had real life paranormal experiences while living in the now demolished Henry Treat Rogers Mansion in Denver, Colorado in the 1960s. So connecting to Shining, because that also takes place in Colorado, although not in Denver, but in the mountains.
Yeah. Well, in the foothills, Estes Park. Yeah. Being, originally from the mountains of Colorado. Yes. Fascinating. I know there's like a, now that I'm thinking about it, there's a lot of like mansions, hotels, stuff in Colorado that are like said to be haunted. Like there's a lot of lore in Colorado around like haunted buildings and stuff. And I don't know the lore, but now that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, oh yeah, there's like a place in Glenwood Springs or Grand Junction that also was like a haunted hotel or. So this is fascinating.
Nice. I'm hoping our BooTube for April, for this month that this episode is coming out, is going to be Rose Red, because I have some fun stories there about the East Bay that's making me think of everything you're talking about now.
Nice. I have some stories too, some of which probably we talked about in our Nerds at Church episode on graveyards and hauntings for our Lent 5 episode, which has not been recorded yet, which came out right before Holy Week.
Very nice.
Sure that those will come up again, but also if you want to check it out, you can, to your listeners.
Well, I guess we can get into the movie now and talk about some of our favorite parts.
Yes. Although you said this is still frequently cited as one of the scariest ghost films ever made. I am surprised by it. Didn't seem particularly scary to me, but that might also have more to do with like how we have structured watching it, where like I don't watch scary movies at night, and so it didn't feel as scary to me. I don't know.
Like there are different types of horror and different types hit different people differently, of course. A movie like this is filled with like dread and unending suspense, which are very scary things, but does it have like jump scares? None that I can think of. Does it have like horrifying things displayed on screen? Or the type of like body horror that makes people ill, like none of that. So it's like, so it depends on like, so I think for a lot of people who saw this movie when it came out, it's kind of like The Shining or The Exorcist, just one of those movies in the 70s and 80s that just very slow, more atmospheric, using the atmosphere to create dread and suspense and horror, as opposed to directly displaying horror on screen.
Yeah,
which I feel like has a way of lasting with you longer than some of like the jump scare movies can or something like that.
I think also for me, and this is probably jumping around, but as someone who has worked as a chaplain and has like a lot of intimate experience with death and dying and compassion for people as they die, my main approach to this was compassion for the ghost, right? Like the idea of ghosts in at its heart is unfinished business, and we'll get to this more in the lore, I think, but for me the whole time it was, oh, this is this guy who's being haunted by this ghost is like the one person that the ghost has a hope could actually help uncover the harm and the violence. And so like I was more interested in that, and like not in a scary way, but in a, oh, this is communication, this is like all of that stuff. So I think that's part of it too, that I just didn't approach it as a horror movie. I approached it as like someone who needs help solving a mystery.
I think that also relates to the five nature. Anytime there's a mystery, it's easy to switch into the I want to solve the mystery mode.
Yep.
It's interesting though, because I feel like The Ring kind of is a weird, like the ring itself comes out of East Asians, Japanese specific culture and the original book and then movie Ringu and stuff. But the American remake, though, clearly was influenced by the Changeling to the point that some of the plot beats are the same, like dead kid found in a well. I mean, being like the central thing, the ghost reaching out from beyond the grave to try to get justice and the truth out there and stuff like that. So I wonder, since you have not seen The Ring in quite some time, if you'll find The Ring quite as scary now, rewatching it, if we end up doing that for... That's up to our listeners, though, if we're going to do it for a movie commentary. Y'all get a chance to vote for that, I think, in May will be that one.
Yeah, that's fascinating because I saw The Ring in, like, high school before I really, like... developed an I don't like horror sense. So that'd be fascinating. That will be fascinating if we watch it. Here's your plug to vote. Follow us so you can vote and hear what I think about the interest. Anyway, so as we roll through the film, because I'm in a rolly chair. And I think you're seated, so we're not walking through it.
As I recline through the film.
The most important scene in the entire film, of course, is the snow.
Yeah, even though it's like this beautiful backdrop to a horrific accident, it's still the best scene.
Yeah, I love snow. The accident, like, they're just, like, nothing about that accident was, like, anybody driving at all properly. Like, that's not... It just wouldn't have happened, right? But it had to happen because we have to kill off these two women in order to jumpstart the plot. Because that is sexism. The sexism and misogyny of... There's like, some...
Wife head in the freezer trope. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a trope, but also a, like, the Bechdel test, but, like, another test is, are any women or girls killed to advance the plot? If so, it fails. And this movie fails that. Also, that, like, the mom goes to grab the kid, and they just, like, fall down instead of, like, grabbing and pulling her out of the path of their car. Also, there's a lot of snow, so there's, like, a small chance that they could have just, like, been pushed down into the snow and not, like, smushed into the pavement. It depends on, like, what kind of snow. It seemed like the kind of snow that maybe would be, like, a helpful protection. I don't know. So, I just love the snow. And the, like, random... Yeah, and basic... And the, like, randomness of, like, a phone... A payphone in the middle of a like.
Well, that's what they used to have to do. Yeah, you would usually have, before the invention of cell phones, you just have payphones in areas that were a little bit less remote. You would have payphones, and in areas that were a little more remote, you might just have a telephone attached to like a telephone pole or something like that. But
yeah, it just
similar to what the police boxes were in Great Britain in the 80s. I mean, in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, and the payphone, the placement of the payphone and all of that is just weird. Like, you should not have to park on one side of the road and then cross the road to reach the payphone. Like, when you're going up and down mountain passes, there's only one pullout. You don't get pullouts on both sides of the road. That's not how it works. And so there's a little bit of unrealism in the setting of the scene, and also there's snow, so I'm happy.
Yeah. But after he gets, but yeah, he's a musician, so after, so this movie opens with that scene, and it's like really kind of shocking. I don't think you're expecting it when how the movie opens.
Yeah, I generally wouldn't expect the very first scene to be that even though I like knew that that was part of the plot, I did not expect it to be the very first scene until it was happening, and I was like, oh, this is okay. Mm-hmm. We're doing it now.
Mm-hmm.
But then he like gets a new job across the country in a heartbeat.
Yeah, well,
what?
Remember, this is 1980, so for a professor of music who is a well-known composer in academia to be able to go from one school to another, very, very easy. Academia no longer is like that. But,
right? Yeah.
But in the glory days of academia, people who were professors like that would basically be able to get a job wherever they wanted after they reach a certain level of accomplishment, whenever and wherever they wanted.
If only. I mean, right. I don't know that I really want that, but like a little bit more access to paid work.
Right.
Yeah.
Just kind of skipping around to some of this, my favorite scenes in the movie. I love the ball that is used at various, like, just anytime the ball appears, it's like very interesting, like how it appears in the box and he's reflecting on his daughter, but then how it appears to bounce as one of the first signs of the ghost, to how he like literally mm-hmm. drops it into the water and it reappears in his house later, like all yeah. the just following the ball throughout that. Another spooky scene is when he's playing the piano and then the door just opens behind him, but slowly opens. And it's not like in movies today, like Paranormal Activity, where that will happen and then it'll be followed by like a
million deaths,
CGI ghost something or there. Like, I just yeah. love that it's that spooky. It's something spooky that happens. It doesn't get an explanation. It doesn't lead to a jump scare. It just is part of the building of the spooky mm-hmm. atmosphere.
Building of tension. Yeah, the ball reminds me of The West Wing. When Toby has, there's a couple episodes in a row where Toby has like, or at least one episode, one big episode on it, but Toby has this ball that he like throws against the wall of his office when he's thinking about things, and it gets really annoying for the person on the other side of the wall, and they talk about it and stuff, and then like at one point, and he's like throwing it at like a glass pane, and then at one point there's like a burst of anger and it gets thrown at the glass. I don't remember if it's by Toby or the other guy, but, and then the glass just like shatters. It's like, well, okay. Yeah. That's where my mind went with that ball. At least.
The other thing I was just thinking about, and I keep coming back to this, is just how atmospheric this film is. And to the extent that it's really hard in modern horror to have a film this devoted to atmosphere, the way mm-hmm. that a movie like The Shining is, or even The Exorcist, like there's just a slowness of pace in mm-hmm. filming that has kind of been lost in the last 40 years. Yeah. So
which
unless it's something,
because movies have also gotten way longer.
Yeah, but
in the last 40 years.
But one of the things, though, about, I mean, this movie is 2 hours long, so I mean, it's pretty long in and of itself.
Yeah.
And also,
I didn't notice the length. So.
And then also, I mean, elevated horror now will do this. Like, if you watch Ari Aster's Midsommar or Hereditary or something like that, like, but that's elevated horror, which is its own thing. We can argue about that when we get around mm-hmm. to doing Nope.
yeah also the other piece that is again the like is a girl killed to advance the plot, the sister, like it just was so weird. It felt like a loose end that never got tied up mm-hmm. or addressed to me, because the prompting and all of this stuff happens because of the sister's accident in 1909, and they find in that, like, in the room that the kid was originally like stuck living in at the top of the stairs while being unable to use his legs. And so, like, could not go up and down the stairs. The sister's stuff is there from 1909,
mm-hmm.
which is weird to have that be there.
Yeah, because she died after her brother did.
Yeah, she dies 3 years after her brother in 1909, and her brother died in 1906. But, like, it just doesn't make, like, her accident never feels like it's just an accident. It feels like there should be something more to it. But then once it gets to the point where they start looking at the brother, then her accident is completely forgotten and ignored, and there's no further investigation into it, which feels mm-hmm. irresponsible.
Yeah, it's very much used in the plot as a red herring, and then the second that they reveal it's not the sister, it's like, oh, don't have to talk about this or worry about this anymore.
Yeah, and I think there's so much that could have been done with that, right? It could have been mm-hmm. part of it being even more complicated.
Awfulness of the parents.
Awful. Yeah, that, like, part of why they didn't come back before 1909 or whatever was that, like, the daughter, like, did they have to, like, flee so the daughter didn't know that her brother died? Did she ever know that her brother died? All of that mm-hmm, stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I think they could have done that differently to deepen the movie, I guess. Which is frequently how it happens, like, when you use women just as plot devices, like, you could have done better. It's a lazy choice, I guess. Which I don't usually use the word lazy, but I think that...
Failure of imagination, to quote Joan of Arcadia, which you have quoted in past seasons to talk about this.
It's true. Yeah. They're on the West Coast. They would be writing Western, not English. It's just...
Does everybody have to ride a specific way and no personal preference or being trained elsewhere?
There is space for personal preference, but in my experience, having learned to horseback ride, and my mom's from Connecticut, and so she grew up learning English, and I grew up in Colorado, and it was only Western. Like, there wasn't space for learning to ride English, except when we were, like, at my grandparents. So the idea that it's, like, proper English is this, like, artificial, it feels like an artificial, like, we shall import the, like, proper, prim and proper of society, you know, Bridgerton, whatever, into the Pacific Coast. Like, it feels like it's coming from someone who doesn't actually know the culture and doesn't actually know the dynamics of the West Coast, and is just like, oh, we'll just throw that in, and it makes them both seem really proper and, like, all of that.
Cool.
That's my opinion. That's my theory.
But I'm also, he came from New York, so he mm-hmm. might have learned out.
Yeah, like, it's not surprising to me that he knows how to write English. It is weird to me that that's what she would default to and automatically do.
Okay. Movies with fires.
And that it's not commented on. Like, it'd be one thing if they commented on it, but no commenting. It's just, like, natural. Whatever. Go off. Have your English date. That's fine.
I love it. Guess that can transition us to talking some theology.
Indeed. Are we still using the, like, the transition music for the deep dive?
Depends how much editing time I have for, but if I take the time and have the time to put it in there, I usually do.
Okay. Just checking. Checking how much we need to actually, like, go against my everything in my nature as, like, an NB who is too NB to transition, or if I, like, really have to work at it.
Just be you.
Okay. Can do. Deeply diving, diving deeply, deeply diving, diving deeply. You're welcome.
So, the changing the title comes from part of European folklore. So changeling in European folklore is a creature that swaps place with a human child, and pretends to be that child, looks like that child, but parents realize over time that it's not their child. And it's often a fairy. Sometimes it could be like related to witchcraft. Sometimes it could be other things, but
so
typically it's a fairy
sense.
Thing.
I was like, where does this title even come from? Okay, thanks.
So, yep. So despite such a creature not appearing in this film, it is still a reference to that kind of swapping of a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's fascinating and makes so much sense. There's a whole bunch with the like child that gets replaced that is the replacement child that is fascinating to me, because his like there's so much space for him to be basically like an innocent in all of this because he was an orphan and he got adopted and all of this stuff, but like his reactions to everything are that he knows something was up and he knew something was up, and which lends itself more towards the fairy type of like somewhat sinister nature of it, because he knows that the situation is not what it seems. There's something untoward happening. But one of the themes that came up for me in this was this idea of helplessness, which starts at the very beginning, right? John is unable to help, even as he sees the accident coming, right? He sees the plow and the other car coming, but he's across the road in a phone booth that he can't like open the door, and so there's just this like helplessness that then also like seeps in as he's experiencing ongoing grief afterwards into his subconscious and his dreams, that it keeps connecting to this helplessness, which then becomes, I think, a path of connection for the ghost, who that like in the midst of John's deep grief and helplessness at having been unable to prevent the accident, there is a space of ability to like, there is a shift in, he was helpless, the child was helpless to prevent his own death, and so then they are able to like meet together in the helplessness to create a different path forward, which I think is yeah.
And like, also love the this kind of gets into a kind of very related to what you're saying, like this notion of loss and grief that permeates the film in such a way that there's like those helpless aspects of grief where you feel helpless. And then there's also those ways of like active, doing something active as a way of hopefully working through grief, or in other times as a way of avoiding grief and focusing on something else. And so I feel like this mystery that he's trying to solve is kind of both tied to this him feeling trying to get justice on behalf of his daughter and wife who died that he had was not able to help, but in this case he can like put those feelings of helplessness into getting justice, but also as a way of finding space for forgiveness of himself, perhaps.
It's like making amends for his inability to act, then he's acting now instead.
Yeah. And grief is kind of a queer liminality in and of itself, so whenever that is shown on film and given space on film, I really appreciate it, unlike the Nightmare on Elm Street films, which we covered last season, where like we have a funeral scene to show, oh, they're sad, okay, funeral scene's over, they're no longer going to mention the dead person or care about the dead person or show any signs of grief for the rest of the movie. Whereas this, like, the whole movie is him dealing with grief, and that's like kind of shown on screen consistently throughout.
Yeah, it's, now I'm wishing that we had had Reverend Colette Brody Grund on, because she created the Grief Lectionary, and we had her for our Slaughter of the Holy Innocents episode, actually, for Nerds at Church this year. But yeah, the space of like grief, I do think that grief is very queer, and that space of like being in it and not just trying to brush it away, but like actively pursuing it, actively like processing it, and letting it be in your body, and then also like listening to the ways that it comes out, not just once, but again and again and again, and in new and different ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe for this season, we'll get back to, or at least I'll get better at putting the books we reference in the show notes. So referencing Lynn-Marie Tonstad's book on, not book, but she wrote an article called Queering Death or Queer Death, which is really on this. And then also personal shout out to an article I wrote a few years back called Queering Grief, about my own journey there. So those two connections in addition to, we'll post that Nerds at Church episode as well.
Mm-hmm. The other piece that comes out in this, and that we've talked about at various points on this podcast, and just in general in life, is the way that disability and ableism come out in this. It is, I know from my experience, I have worked with adults with intellectual disabilities, and so both there and as a chaplain, I've had to do like mandatory reporter training on vulnerable adults and child abuse and those sorts of things. And like statistically, disabled people are way more likely to be victims of abuse than able-bodied people, especially like for cognitive disabilities, but like both cognitive and physical disabilities. And so, and like the most common cause of death is like actually like being killed by a caregiver, whether that's like someone who's employed or a lot of the times a family member. And so this just was like, ugh, in that, because mm-hmm. that's exactly what happens, right? There is the child is clearly abused in that he is restricted to one room in the house and is unable to access other spaces in the house. Even though there are floors where he could have a room in the floor and still be able to navigate around in the wheelchair that he clearly has, but also then to literally be killed in the bathtub, and that space of just like being killed by the person who is supposed to be caring for you, and then the way that the horror is the process of uncovering abuse. And this is why like I go into investigative mode, right? Because the horror is what happened to the child and the cover-up mm-hmm. that followed and the why and all of that stuff. The horror is not the child finally getting heard and finally getting recognized for, like, what they experienced.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that that's just, like, this really interesting dynamic in this point that, like, reflects so much of how disabled people have been treated and continue to be treated, particularly in this country, but like everywhere.
Yeah. And then also the meta conversation of how disability is treated in film, and similar to the women and girl trope, how often disabled people are killed or put into a position solely to move the plot along. And that really is the case here. Like, it's the only agency the child has is in the ghostly acts to try to get his justice heard, but like there's no agency in his life or in his death, and it's and just kind of being robbed and devoid of all of that in a way that just like... both as like part of the plot, like showing the light on that and revealing that, but then also part of just the bias of filmmakers and audiences to not even question or comment mm-hmm. when disability shows up in film as a plot device.
Yeah.
There's also this sense of justice as something that is brought upon the child of the sinning parent, which is one of the many ways the Bible talks about justice. It is not the only way, and is in fact something that most people today would say is a harmful way the Bible talks about justice. But basically, this idea that the parent fucked up, so the child gets punished, or the generations after the parent gets punished. And so here we have this senator who was not involved in the death of who he replaced. He was an orphan. He was presumably brought into the family after this happened. Wasn't part of the family or knew of the kid before the kid died. Questions how much the senator knew all along throughout the film. And yet he's the one who gets killed at the end and punished. But also, it's clear the senator knows something and was willing to reap in the wealth and benefit of living this falsehood. And it was not lost on me that the senator looks a lot like Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa, someone who I have met. So that was also in my head during all of this too. But
Senator Grassley is not a senator that I would trust with anything. But it is simultaneously not his fault that the other kid was killed. And he pays significant amounts of money so that that house is never rented out. It's never leased. It's never to keep that secret and to keep that ghost from revealing the secrets. And so it's did he deserve to die? I don't think so. But did he deserve some sort of consequences for his covering up what he knew was injustice, even if he didn't know all of the details of it?
That wasn't very ELCA Lutheran of you, though, because the wages of sin are death, according to Luther, so all of us deserve to die. It's only God's grace that redeems us.
I mean, yes. And that doesn't mean that we deserve the punishment of death before, we actually live our lives. Pace, you are playing with words.
You should appreciate that. You're 5. That's all y'all do.
Yeah. But that's manipulating words in a way that is not what I was talking about. I'm just saying. And I think the other thing that I think is mostly in my head because of our last season is the house as a character. And that definitely happens throughout the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. It's not the first in the first movie per se, but then the way that the house is talked about by the senator's friend at the historical society who keeps creepily warning them to stay away. Is that the house might have preferences and the house doesn't want people, and which is interesting because what it really wants is to communicate, but really even deeper than that, the ghost, the child, wants to communicate. And so this one starts out and there's an assumption of the house as a character, and then it shifts some to maybe it's not that the house is the character, maybe it is that it's a ghost and the ghost is the character, because the ghost also then helps the christening medal be found in the well where the kid was buried, which why didn't they just keep the christening medal? I don't know. Give it to the other kid. Also, does this mean that kid was never baptized?
I mean, he's an orphan, so if he was baptized, he might have been. That's a good question. Who knows? But that brings to the theological point that of baptism being a big part of this movie, weirdly. Whether it's intentional or not, I don't know. But the whole thing with the christening medal being something that is gifted to a child upon baptism, in some traditions, mostly Catholic, regional traditions, and it will usually be stamped with a date, the child's name, and then have an image of a saint or something on it, or the cross. And that being the central piece in this story to the fact that the kid is drowned and baptism is a theological symbol of drowning to
literally
of drowning and then
Christ.
being brought back to life, and then being then buried in a well, so another like water symbol. The weird way that water and drowning and death and baptism all keep showing up throughout this movie.
Yeah, it is fascinating to me. There's also so much about this movie that connects with the couple of gospel readings we've had in Lent, which is right around when we are recording this, because we have the Samaritan woman at the well and the like conversation about living water. And so like Nerds at Church did a deep dive into wells. But then the next week after that was the story of the man born blind. And the beginning of that story is a question from the disciples to Jesus, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind. And that idea of like the sin always has to be like that disability is connected to sin and that sort of a thing. And and to be like, actually, no, this is for the glory of God. This is that God's glory might be revealed in him. And so, yeah, I was baptized into a Catholic church and did not get a christening medal at all. Had not ever heard of it until we watched this movie. And then I was like, oh, okay. And there's something there, though, of like identity. Mm-hmm. That the christening medal was buried with the child, that there is this preciousness to the child, right, that this child is still wrapped in God's love even as the kid's own father kills and abandons him. But that it's still not beyond the love of God, which I really like as, you know, a Christian and stuff. Also, the misogyny and the sexism, right? Like, the daughter dies in 1909, but, like, all of the inheritance went to the son, and none of it went to the daughter. Well, the grandson and the granddaughter. And none of it went to the daughter, because that seems really rude, where, like, if this kid dies, everything goes to charity, and the granddaughter is just, like, screwed.
Right. Also, it's very obvious in ways like that. And then also, I would say a little more subtle, but just also in the ways that George C. Scott's character, John, just is able to have, like, not have to worry about any of the upkeep of the house because there are, like, servants and right. women it's around like, do that work
servant,
for him and stuff
servant.
Like
everywhere
that.
Everywhere that anything needs to happen, when he hears the banging on the pipes, everything is, oh, there's a servant to, like, investigate that. So he's never in any actual danger. There's,
right.
Yeah, we'll pay somebody to come in and do a seance to figure this out and...
But then I do like the reversal at the end, how it is the woman who rescues him from the burning building. He was the person in distress and rescued by a woman. So,
yeah.
Tiny cool. subverting of the trope after rest of a sexist movie.
Right. And saved by his wife. His, like, real life wife.
Yeah. Yeah. So we did this in our vampire season, and we're bringing it back. So... kind of the pattern has been every other season is a little bit shorter and we focus on some sort of supernatural entity such as vampire, this season a ghost, future season witches, whatever, werewolves, we have a whole bunch we want to get to, and then the opposing seasons are a little bit longer and they might have a loose theme, like last one was unintentionally nightmares and they follow Nightmare on Elm Street, but it's not as much of a tracking of tropes throughout the movie. But for this one, as a shorter one, we're going to kind of track the ghost lore whenever something does something, whenever a movie does something a little novel or adding to the lore or something like that, just to kind of keep track of what the genre, how ghost genre has changed and evolved over the past 40 years since this movie and The Shining, which we saw last season.
Yeah. So one of the things that I always have to bring up that, like, ever since I was told about this, I was like, oh my gosh, this is brilliant, right? The dynamic of, is it a ghost or is it ADHD, right? When he, like, goes through and is, like, turning off the water in the house and that sort of thing. And it's just like, there was a TikTok a while back, and I won't be able to find it again, but, like, of someone with ADHD and a ghost, and, like, the ghost is, like, finally is like, why haven't you gotten creeped out and left yet? And the person's like, what? Why would I? And they're like, because I keep turning off the lights, turning on the lights, doing all this stuff. And they're like, oh, I just thought it was my ADHD. So yeah. I would love some sort of, like, actual, like, movie or something that, like, plays with that, because I think that would be fun and playful way to,
because, like, something many of us ADHD people do is leave cupboards open. Mm-hmm. It's just it's a visual. There's a variety of theories for why we do that. Some of it is just being distracted, which ADHD does. Others is this part of, like, if you don't see it, you don't know what's there. So having the cabinet opens helps you see and know what's there and remind you. Or, like, if you're unloading the dishwasher and you leave the cabinet open when you're not finished, and it's a visual reminder to come back, finish, that kind of stuff. But that's also a trope in a lot of ghost movies, is, like, the first sign of a ghost is that the cabinets will just weirdly be opened. And it's like, yeah, no, that could totally be an ADHD person living in that house. It might not be a ghost at all. But so I'm with you 100% on that. Strangely, cabinet doors opening was not part of this movie, but it will be some of the other ones we do.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I think there's also one of the things that is very connected to ghosts is, like, a hidden harm or a hidden truth that is part of why the ghost is a ghost and hasn't just, like, died and passed on peacefully. And that, like, goes into the...
Just the idea that ghosts are frequently defined in this movie basically runs with this as well, as the spirit of a dead human with unfinished business, whatever that might mean. And that is presumably when they have finished business, they can finish whatever business they were behind, left behind. Then they can go to rest, go to the afterlife, heaven, hell, whatever. Great ether, but they must finish the business first, and that this ghost's unfinished business was to find justice and being and that's through that finding of justice and the getting revenge on his adopted brother, I guess, / person, doppelganger, whatever. is able to finally get rest, presumably.
There's also, like, sometimes ghosts can interact with solid objects and sometimes they can't, and sometimes it's only certain ones. So this ghost can interact with solid objects and can go other places. So there's a little bit of, like, teleportation, both with, like, retrieving the ball from the river thing and from showing up in the well, and making the christening metal rise to the top of the dirt.
Unlike, for instance, Beetlejuice, where, like, which we just watched from movie commentary, where they open the door of their house and there's nothing, like, they can't leave. It's just they go into another dimension. Whereas this ghost clearly can leave their house and interact with other places.
Yeah. And, kill the cop.
Yeah, that too. Weird.
Forgot about that.
Seances show up a lot in haunted house movies. And basically ever since The Haunting of Hill House, Shirley Jackson's book, like, seances just show up at least once in every haunted house movie ever. So I always like to pay attention when it shows up, and in this one it shows up.
Yep. Yeah.
Any other ghost lore for now?
I think that's all I've got for now.
Same. Well, we can rate this movie. We haven't seen Ghostbusters yet, but you can probably remember enough from Ghostbusters to pick a good rating thing that ties in with that franchise.
Oh, I was just thinking of, like, how many out of 10 ghosts or haunts, or I don't know.
I was thinking, like, proton packs to tie in with Ghostbusters, or Stave Puffed Marshmallows, I don't know.
Stay Puffed Marshmallows. I love Stay Puffed Marshmallows, but let's go with Proton Packs.
Okay. So I have 10 Proton Packs, since this is our Ghostbuster season. How many would you rate this? And there aren't that many kill. There are a few, though. So do you have a favorite kill in this?
Yes, I do. I would go with 8 Proton Packs.
Nice.
I really liked the movie. I thought it was really good, aside from all of the, like, sexism and ableism, which knocked it down a bit. But I liked the way that it... I liked the style of the movie more than The Shining. Like, I know that they're very connected and related, but they just felt very different. And I think part of it is, like, both of them have sexism and misogyny, but, like, the main character in The Shining is, like, a misogynist, abusive asshole. And it's not as much about, like, finding out what is going on and what harm has happened. And so I really like that aspect of this one, I think. And then, unsurprising to most people who know me, my favorite kill is probably the cop, who is literally, like, showing up to impede the discovery of truth. Work, yeah. My favorite kill. What about you?
I was tempted to say that one, but my favorite death is the opening scene, just because it's so, like, jarring way to open a movie and unexpected. And I would also...
There's so much snow there, and that always makes it
better. Yeah. Right, right. But I would also rate this an 8 proton packs. So, nice. Yeah.
Any reasoning behind your 8, or just, like, an 8?
It's a great movie. Classic. Still love it. Love what it's done for the genre. It's a little slow at some points. Yeah. 8 is good, but not...
It's
the
not
best
the 2016
movie.
Ghostbusters. Okay, gotcha.
You'll see where I'll rate that. We'll get there. How many times did you jump this movie?
Our jump tracker. I'm excited for the jump tracker in this in this season, because I think there are more jump scares in these movies. I did not jump at all. So very proud of that fact. Also, it wasn't like a jump scare movie, really. Did you jump at all?
I feel like I did not. I feel like, though, if we want to do jump scare seriously, we'll have to start watching the movies in ways that they're meant to be watched.
Yeah, I feel like I was thinking about that might slowly easing into that is the tricky part. Mm-hmm. Like, we've watched a couple movies when it's not super light out. So there's, like, progress in that direction. Yeah. We're like finding a comfort zone and then pushing it, and then establishing comfort there and then pushing it. So, like, we're like getting there.
Yeah. Getting there. Yeah. So, our next movie, though, is the first entry in the Ghostbusters franchise, the original Ghostbusters, 1984, and we'll be joined by Bobby Likes It Spooky himself, Bobby Torres. Very excited to have him on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited for that. I'm excited for the thing. I'm excited for all the things. And that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt May. Horror Nerds at Church releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, YouTube episodes, and more bonus content by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. It's only $5 or $10 to sign up. Cheaper than a christening medal, for sure. Especially a replacement one. And the secrecy that is paid off for that. Follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Horror Nerds at Church, and Twitter at HNACPOD for all the latest updates about upcoming films, news, and other announcements. Until next time, don't bury the truth, just bury the dead.
Oh, I like that.